Welcome, everyone, to Wise Talk. This is Mariposa's monthly podcast. We provide perspectives on leadership. Today, we're excited to welcome Justin Talbot Zorn and Lee Martz. Justin is an author and policymaker who has served as both a strategist and meditation teacher in the US Congress, a Harvard and Oxford trained specialist in the economics and psychology of human thriving. Justin's writing on mindfulness and politics has been published in 12 languages, and his work has appeared in the Washington Post, The Atlantic, Harvard Business Review, Foreign Policy, and other publications. Welcome, Justin. So glad to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Lee is a leadership coach and collaboration consultant specializing in work with scientists, engineers, and creatives. She spent years working with the climate team at NASA Goddard Space Flight Center and over a decade facilitating and advising a cross-sector team of chemists, advocates, government regulators, manufacturers, and retailers aiming to reduce toxic chemicals in our homes and environment. Welcome, Lee, from Berkeley.
Thank you.
And then Justin is in Santa Fe. Your new book is titled Golden, The Power of Silence in a World of Noise. So very interesting title. And I did just read your bio, but I want to just kind of jump in to find out kind of how you got there. You both coming from very interesting backgrounds, different backgrounds. And curious if you could just start, Justin, with how you got here to end up writing this book with Lee.
For sure, Sue. Thank you so much for that kind introduction. This book grew out of a feeling of despondence, a feeling of just being totally stuck. As you mentioned, I was working in the U.S. Congress as a policy advisor, legislative director, three members of Congress, and also a meditation teacher. And Lee was working with NASA and Google and other clients on environmental and social justice causes, coalition building. And we both just had this feeling like there was something blocking our ability with our colleagues to get into meaningful conversations on topics. Like there was something blocking our ability to really generate truly creative solutions to the mounting problems that seem to be afflicting our organizations and humanity. And through that, we both felt an intuition that the prerequisite to finding any answer wasn't just getting beyond the noise, but tuning into silence as the source of good ideas. So we wrote an article about that, about the power of silence. Lee, you want to speak to that?
Yeah. So yeah, we did decide to start writing together. We wrote an article in Harvard Business Review, and to our surprise, it went viral. And so we took that as a signal that something, we were hitting on something important, and we stepped back a few steps to see what was wanting to happen. And we just started to have these conversations, interviews, if you will, with neuroscientists and artists and politicians, a man incarcerated on death row, poets, you know, a whirling dervish, a Grammy-winning opera singer, all sorts of folks who were deeply interested and devoted to silence. And we asked them all this question, what's the deepest silence you've ever known? And their answers are really what this book, what shaped this book. They took us in all kinds of directions. And much to our surprise, their answers were not always auditorily quiet. They were pointing towards big moments in their lives, births and deaths and moments of awe and moments running the perfect line through Roaring Rapids or the 4 a.m. mark at an all-night dance party. And so we really took that information in to see what is it, what is the silence, this deepest silence that all these people are pointing us towards. And this book is a collection of really why silence is important, how to find it as well.
Wow. That's a great question. I don't think anyone's ever asked me that question. And I have so many questions about that question. But before we do it, I know you wanted to read us something.
Well, you're right? About to get your wish right here, right now.
Okay.
I'm going to ask you this question. So this is a moment where you can just settle in comfortably if you're listening. And this is the opening of the book. Chapter one, an invitation. What's the deepest silence you've ever known? You can trust the first memory that comes to you. No need to overthink it. As you remember the experience, see if you can settle into it. Recall where you are, what's happening around you, and who, if anyone, is present. See if you can summon the atmosphere, the quality of light, the mood in the air, the feeling in your body. Is it quiet to the ears? Or is it the kind of silence that comes when no person or thing can claim on your attention? Is it quiet in your nerves? Or is it the kind of silence that lives deeper still, like when the turbulent waters of internal chatter suddenly part, revealing a clear path forward? Take a moment to consider what might sound like a strange question. Is the silence simply the absence of noise, or is it also a presence unto itself?
It's really great. I do want to invite everybody to, as you were listening, I'm sure you were thinking about it. So I'm going to invite us to, at some point, be able to share. Let's kick a couple of questions first before we do that, though. So many things I want to ask. So how do you delineate between silence and peacefulness? Because when you first asked me the question, or asked the question, I really went to like having a sense of peacefulness. So talk to us a little bit about that.
It's a good question, Sue. Thank you. You know, one way to think of it is, you know, at the most basic level, we think of silence as the absence of noise, but mm-hmm. also at a deeper level, as we described it, it's also this presence. It could be something more than just an absence. And this presence, yeah, we could describe that as peacefulness. Certainly, everyone has their own way of describing it, this experience. And part of the reason this passage Lee read is called an invitation is we really want it to be an invitation for each reader, each person involved to feel into what silence is in their own personal experience, in your own personal experience. Mm-hmm. But at the most basic level, we do think of silence as the absence of noise, you know, at the primary level. And noise, as we see it, is unwanted distraction. It's unwanted interference, not just in our ears, but also on our screens and in our heads. Not just the auditory noise, but the informational noise and the internal noise, too. So part of the process of writing this book was exploring how the world really is getting noisier in terms of more and more unwanted interference. Yeah, maybe that's not a surprise, but you know, the National Park Service estimates that noise pollution in rural areas increases 2 to 3-fold every 30 years. Mm. 450 million people in Europe now live with noise levels that the World Health Organization says are hazardous to health. You know, and then in 2010, Eric Schmidt, when he was CEO of Google, mm-hmm. said every 2 days we now create as much information as we did from the dawn of civilization until 2003. You know, and I, you know, probably don't need to say much about the noise of the attention economy. But one thing we explored is how all the auditory and informational noise of the world really does create more noise inside of our consciousness, inside of our heads. So Ethan Cross, a psychologist at the University of Michigan, estimates that we have to listen to something like 320 State of the Union addresses worth of inner monologue on any given day, because compressed speech is up to about 4,000 words per minute. So things are getting noisier even inside our own consciousness. So in the book, we look at the economics and sociology of mm-hmm. why things are so noisy. But then that brings us to this meaning of silence. I mean, Lee, what would you say about that, about silence and peacefulness, the meaning mm-hmm. of silence?
Well, I love that. I think that our internal experience, it actually points to how subjective silence is for us. And we're moving away from, even in this conversation and taking a moment to be with the opening words, our concept of silence versus our felt sense of silence. So your felt sense, that peacefulness, may be kind of how it lives in you. Mm-hmm. For others, they may describe it really differently. And that's, again, what we're doing with the readers, is pointing them towards their experience of silence, what it truly is in the moment. We spoke with a professor of biobehavioral health and medicine at Penn State, Joshua Smythe, who were asking him for a great, like, can you give us a good definition for internal silence? And in frustration, he said, you know, quiet is what people think quiet is. Mm-hmm. We might tweak that to just say, like, quiet is what we actually experience quiet to be. And that could be surprising. And in our interviews, that's exactly what we found. He actually pointed us towards someone in his studies. He does large scale stress reduction studies. And he had a participant in that study who found his deepest quiet, he said, while carving with a chainsaw big hunks of wood. That's when he would find his deepest quiet. And for others, you talked about, you know, mountaineering or flow states or different, you know, things, or maybe this deep reading or poetry or looking at art or playing with our children, any number of experiences where we find the internal chatter that Justin was just describing falls away, and our ability to give our full pristine attention to something is there. We may even feel completely, you know, out of connection to that, like the egoic self. We may feel more connected to all things in that kind of an expansive way. So there's many ways to describe silence, that experience of silence. And that's what we're interested in, not being super prescriptive and really, really kind of firm in our definition, but pointing the reader and anyone here and anyone who listens to their silence. We believe that this is innate to being human. We know our way. We know our way there.
Interesting. So it's innate. Okay. So I'm hearing peacefulness. I'm hearing absence of noise. I'm hearing presence. Now, what do we do with solitude? Now, the absence of noise is like more of acute, like a moment of silence, literally. Like there's no noise right there. But solitude is a more of a state of being. Presence, I think, is even more of a state of being. Peacefulness is more of a state of being. So anything you want to address in terms of sort of that idea of solitude, delineate between solitude and silence?
Sure. Yeah. So we think of silence really as the space where no one's making claims on your consciousness, the space where nothing is interfering with your perception and your intention. You know, and it's in this way that we could start to explore silence as this presence unto itself. You know, it's this place, as you were describing, a presence and also describing a way of being. It's a stance of not knowing, a place of letting go. It's accepting that it's okay to not fill the space. It's good to just be. And within that, we can find that those states are often heightened amidst other people. We find that the power of silence is magnified when it's shared. So it's not something that's opposed to, you know, being present with other people. It's not just a state of solitude, even though it often is, you know, a state we find in solitude these days. Silence can be powerful. This state of pristine attention can be powerful amidst other people. Lee, what would you add to that?
Just that was a really important thing for us to bring forward with this book, as a relationship worker, a systems worker in the world, people engaged in full lives with family members and all these, you know, kind of coalitions and things that we run in, and what we noticed in our deepest silence is that those were shared moments as well. So this is not to say if your deepest silence is in solitude, you know, that isn't just fine or perfectly powerful, but we noticed there was a bit of a collapse between silence and solitude, and that the silence, when it's shared in these, you know, with our family, with our coworkers, as cultural events, was profound and worth highlighting. So in the book, we do talk about practices to do solo, because, you know, those are usually the easiest ones to make happen, but then also the ones we can do with our family, our children, our friends, our coworkers, and at large, as a society.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And Sue, I want to also just share that I think these questions around the meaning of noise and the meaning of silence really get to the essence of why we wrote this book, which is really around some of the discourse and the state of mindfulness in the places we've worked, in the places, you know, just in our culture. And we really wanted to write this book as a kind of non-meditator's guide to getting beyond the noise. Because, you know, we've had 40 years of mindfulness now in the culture, and the world is more distracted than ever. I mean, we're people who have certainly appreciated our mindfulness practices over the years, and we've been teachers. But part of why we wanted to write this book was to give people a kind of license to look beyond the traditional rules and tools of mindfulness and hone in to your own understanding of what silence is for you. Part of the reason we explore people's experience of silence and explore this subjective feeling of silence rather than giving the rigid definition is because we want to create a kind of field guide for people to be able to navigate the auditory and informational and internal noise and interference of the world and give up on questions like, am I doing it right with meditation? Mm-hmm. But let people trust that each one of us in our own way knows what silence feels like. You know, as Lee was just saying, it's something innate, it's something inherent to being human. So how do we hone in to our experience of this pristine attention?
So I experience mindfulness as a way to get present. And it sounds like there's other tools that you don't want to you don't necessarily want to just focus on mindfulness, meditation. And I use mindfulness as meditation, the same.
Yeah.
Mindfulness is an aspect of meditation, a certain kind of meditation. So are there other ways to get to the silence? I mean, really, mindfulness meditation is a way to get to the silence and get to the presence. So that's a tool, really. It's a good tool. I want you to address mindfulness and how that's related to silence. And then I also want you to address other ways to get to silence.
Mm-hmm. As Justin was saying, like, mindfulness meditation has been in our past a profound mm-hmm. way to find silence. And what we found with Justin teaching it in Congress and me teaching it with different clients, just even little elements of it. And there's definitely a relationship for those like you, me, and Justin, where it connects to silence. That's an awesome practice. What I found personally is that in this phase of life, mindfulness and meditation is actually not my direct route to silence. I'm so appreciative of all that I've learned, but I actually find a lot more silence, internal silence, teaching my dance class twice a week in a flow state. And feeling that joy and exuberance in auditorily loud environments, but where mm-hmm, there's mm-hmm. not one single thought that can creep into my head without me messing up mm-hmm. my steps. So the mm-hmm. feedback loop is direct. And for so many people, that connection of mindfulness and silence, or the meditation sounds, it's just not their way to silence. And so we wanted to say, like, you know, let that go. If it's not your way, let it go. There are so many ways. Infinite ways, truly, to mm-hmm. find our way. Mm-hmm. So what we do in the book is give this like wide range of possibilities mm-hmm. so that people can start to tune into the signals in their bodies, in their mental states, their moods, in their relationships, and their tasks, so they can start to tune in. Am I in that place of saturation of noise, and maybe what type, auditory, informational, internal? So notice noise, but they can tune into silence and notice, what are the signals that I'm really finding that rest and rejuvenation and ability to reflect, to get insight? What are those? Is it the hot shower I take where the ideas start flooding in? Is it stepping outside and listening to the song, the bird songs? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, what are those ways? And to not really worry about that, any kind of a hierarchy of it, one's better than the other,
right?
You know, like, there's one way. So.
Right. Well, the interesting about meditation is that, especially when you're first starting it, either in the first part of it or when you're first starting as a beginner, I mean, it's actually not silent because you're more attuned to your head being all over the place.
You really hear how loud it is. Yeah.
That's right. That's right.
Whoa.
Yeah. So it can be a source and it cannot. And I think I like your idea of flow. I was, when you first said it, I thought of skiing because when I'm skiing, you cannot, you know, focus on anything else. And otherwise you're going to catch an edge, especially the way I ski. So it is the most flow state I could be in. And to hear myself, it's a time where I can actually hear myself breathe because you're so bundled up, right, usually. And so you really feel the flow. And I guess it would be similar to the dance situation. So, yeah. What about you, Justin?
You know, I find it, I have 2-year-old twins and a 5-year-old in the house and a pretty full work schedule and community commitments. And so I find it really, Sue, in micro moments. Mm-hmm. I go out in the middle of a busy day of meetings and I go outside by the juniper tree in my backyard and I feel the rays of the sun and I just listen. And a big part of what we explore in this book is the power of just simply listening to nothing in particular. There was a research study at Duke Medical School some years ago that looked at the effect of different kinds of sounds on the hippocampus of mice. They looked at Mozart and pup sounds and white noise, and it was silence that produced the most demonstrable increase in neurons in this part of the brain associated with memory. So there's growing research showing that the act of listening in silence regenerates the brain. And it's something, if you look at the ancient practice of Nada Yoga from India, a yogic practice of listening to the sound, the inner sound, or the sound of silence, or even the sound, the ringing in someone's own ears, that there's something really regenerative about this. And we don't have to have fancy bells and cushions or mindfulness training in order to do that. You know, part of what we want to do in this book, as we were saying before, is just give people license to simply be in silence and to let this be a practice.
I want to open it up to the couple people that are on the call, that if you want to share, you can get yourself on video if you'd like, and obviously on mute, you'd like to share the answer to Lee's original question, which is, what has been the most silence? Is that
what's the moment deepest, of the deepest silence deepest. You've ever known? Yeah. And I do see in the chat the state of awe Maynard speaks to. And actually, you know, I mentioned flow states, but I do want to say moments of awe, I would also put in there, we put in there in the book. Actually, there's a whole umbrella term for self-transcendent experiences. STE is a new area of science, neuroscience.
Yeah. The STDs, STEs. I like
yeah,
that.
Way better than STDs is the STE, the self-transcendent experience where you really go move beyond your egoic self, where you lose that capacity or temporarily lose the capacity for self-reflective thought. So because you're so focused on what you're doing, you're so in awe of this tree in front of you, to use Maynard's example, or you're like shredding down the hill like you are describing.
Yeah.
You do. So you are so focused there that you don't have attentional space for self-reflective thought. You're just in it. And also you're of it, like you're connected to the natural world, you know, your greater source, your God, your this, your that, we all humanity, who knows? So these states, that umbrella term, we put flow states, moments of awe, and even mystical experiences fall under there, and meditation and dance and all kinds of, you know, skiing and all kinds of things can fall under there. Yeah.
Would someone like to share?
Yeah, the experience that came to mind, it's one I was actually thinking about in a different way very recently, but it was quite a number of years ago. The first time I was in the Grand Canyon, this was a boat trip down the Grand Canyon. And I had started that trip afraid of heights, not realizing that side hikes in the canyon are going to be up. And so I'd had an early experience of, oh, well, if I'm going to enjoy this, I have to climb stuff. And maybe 10 days later, we were at a particularly gorgeous spot, and one of the wonderful guides was giving a little more geology than I really wanted. And I just took off up a chimney. There was another way to get around to get into this side canyon, but I took off up a chimney. So there's the noise of the Colorado. There's two or three dozen other people there, not that kind of silence. But there was an attention, first of all, to what I wanted to do and to this new capacity I had discovered, that I could actually climb things and be exhilarated by it. So I'm kind of curious also, where does exhilaration connect to awe? Because as I spoke that, I thought, oh, that was part of it. Something new and extraordinary and delightful.
I love that. You know, and part of what I love so much about that, Deborah, is this framework we bring in the book about the auditory noise, the informational noise, the internal noise. What you're describing about this experience inside the Grand Canyon on the river is just like, gets to these feedback loops, to these different kinds of silence, you know, because there's the great silence of this massive cavern that you're traversing here. And then there's the silence of being away from, you know, the ordinary worries and distractions of our online lives and our working lives these days. And then as you talk about exhilaration, it brings to mind what Sue was just describing about skiing. Being in this place where we're so immersed in what we're doing that if you entertain a thought that's going to pull you out of the moment, you're subject to lose the moment. You know, exhilaration pulls us into this presence. And we call exhilaration, you know, we describe what you're describing as exhilaration or this kind of peak experience as a kind of silence in this framework we work with in this book, because it's a silencing of discursive thought in the mind. It's a silencing of that bottom-up internal distraction at the same time as all those usual distractions in our lives are also silenced. So we often in our culture think of silence as something really somber, like let's have a moment of silence, you know, to honor whatever it is to honor. But this is a reframing of silence as these kinds of states of optimal experience, another side of silence.
You have a follow, Deborah?
Just thank you. And yeah, connecting that, this was such, for me, it was a relatively new kind of somatic focusing. And yeah, once I'd made the decision that I was doing it, there was no room for anything, any internal debate except this handhold, not that one.
Yeah. That's great.
So what a great, thank great, you. That's a great wonderful story. Frame.
Yeah, yeah, that's a great story. Thank you.
Thank you, Deborah.
I mean, a bunch of thoughts come up. I mean, one is I'm pretty extroverted, but I love the quiet. And a friend, ironically, I'm experiencing all this synchronicity, called me and he was in Kauai and he was asking me about a sensory deprivation tank and he was going to do that. And that brought up for me about the ultimate silence for me when he didn't want the lid put on. I wouldn't want the lid put on either. You know, but the quiet of being in that sensory deprivation, it was like a 60s thing, like years ago. Right. And, you know, with the salt, I don't remember, you know, it was so long ago. It was just, yeah, it was just total pure silence.
I love that, Maynard. It gets into so many of the core themes of this book, what you're touching on.
I can't wait to get the book. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll read it in silence.
Probably would have come to this conversation differently if I hadn't seen 13 Lives last night. And if you haven't seen it yet, this is the story of the 13 boys, 12 boys and their coach in Thailand and how they were rescued. And I usually cry at movies. That's kind of what I do. It's my chance to be, actually a way for me to be silent and cry by myself if I want to, or with others. And people are like, what's wrong with you? Nothing. I'm just crying. It's just emotional. But I was crying through the whole movie because what this coach did for these kids to allow them to be there for 8 days without food. Can you imagine this? 8 days in a cave. So talk about silence and deprivation.
Yeah.
They're in a dark cave and they didn't have flashlights because they ran out. I mean, eventually. And he had them meditate a lot. I don't know how much, but probably the bulk of the day so that they could not be in fear. If you have ever a chance to interview these anybody associated with this, it would be fascinating in terms of what you guys are doing with your book because and you definitely need to see the movie, obviously. And there's apparently a plethora of these movies out now about this situation. This one happened to be on Prime and it just came out. There's another one coming out September 22nd on Netflix. That's actually from the perspective of the kids and the coach. So it's a little different. This one was perspective of the West, definitely a Western perspective about the people who saved them, essentially, who are Western. I'm wondering about the idea of silence in applied. So like in that situation is obviously extreme, but let's bring it back to where it's a little bit more practical to, let's say, the workplace. I mean, what are some ways that we can be in silence to help in the workplace? Like why do we care? Why do we?
I'll start us rolling. Actually, I'll just start with where you took us initially with the young boys in the cave, because mm-hmm. we also really wanted this we wanted to turn towards a teacher who really had plumbed the depths of noise and silence. And so the main teacher to come in the book is Jarvis J. Masters. And for those of you who don't know him, he's on death row for a crime that the preponderance of evidence is that he did not commit. And we certainly believe that. He is in one of the most auditorily loud, echoous, cavernous, trash talk and all the time shouting, hollering, lo-fi radios, party beats, interruptions, Jarvis, like all the time, from other people on the tier, and yet he has in that intolerable environment of all kinds of, because there's also, of course, the reverberations of fear and the what's going on with my case and my attorneys and all this stuff happening. So it is not just auditory, but internal. He has managed to find a way to find quiet, and he becomes the teacher in here, as he's a profound Tibetan Buddhist teacher, but he also finds his quiet. And he likes to talk about just like working out in his cell or studying astronomy or, you know, any number writing, which he's written two books in that setting that we just described, finding the little places of silence that he can drop into. Like Justin was describing, it's not so different, you know, sort of just finding it anywhere because it's always actually available. So he became our primary teacher for really sorting out where you can find your sphere of control, even in that environment, or even in the depths of a cave and that kind of a crisis. Where is your sphere of influence? Sort of that middle road where you may not have all the control you'd like, but you can perhaps do some, you know, do some negotiating with others around you, or where do you not have control and you just have to let it go because that's just not the place. It creates too much noise to try to control things in those environments. And he taught us so much about finding quiet in those really impossible situations. And of course, like we thought to ourselves, you know, if he can do it, then we can do it. We can find our way. We can find our little piece of control. So that's where I start. Justin, where do you want to take us from there? Get into some workplace stuff too, but anything else to say about Jarvis?
We really turn to Jarvis because he's in the soup. He's in the muck. He's in the thickest noise you can imagine. We didn't want to write a book, Sue, about how to find silence by running off to a monastery or running away from the noise of the world. This is a book about how to find silence amidst it all. So, you know, with respect to the power of silence for teams, for groups of people, we mentioned this idea that the power of silence is magnified when it's shared. And we look at the example of the Constitutional Convention in 1787, how the delegates had a giant mound of dirt built outside the convention hall so that they could have pristine focus as they were doing the difficult work of drafting the Constitution. If you fast forward some 200 plus years to the time when I was working on Capitol Hill in DC, it was the polar opposite. You couldn't possibly, it's hard to imagine a setting that you could have designed for more noise than that. The TVs blaring, MSNBC or Fox News, depending on the partisan affiliation, nonstop texts and emails and expectations of dropping what you're doing. So what we take from this transition, you know, US lawmakers 200 plus years ago to today, is this idea that you can have a culture that honors quiet or not. You can have a culture of noise or you can have a culture of quiet. And we explore in the book how this applies, you know, not just to a workplace, but to a home as well, or to a group of friends, or, you know, many different social contexts. So in the book, we explore what it means to build a culture of quiet and how building such a culture often requires a little bit of conversation about our expectations, about our needs for quiet, talking about the ways that we create noise and what we expect of others, the way others might create noise. And then starting experiments to see how we could find more pristine attention in our lives. So in the book, we explore what some of those experiments look like. We explore what it means to bring silence into heated deliberations, debates, discussions about contentious topics, creative processes like brainstorming. So we could get into some of those specifics.
Yeah, why don't we? Because I think that it's, when I look at it, it's about creating space. It's very hard for me to separate silence, time, and space. I've always had a hard time separating time and space anyway. I really think they're the same. So I'm coming from a quantum physics perspective, I guess. And same with silence. It's really hard for me to, even in my body, to delineate between silence and space. It just, whenever I think I need to be in silence, I think I have to create space.
Yeah.
So I cannot separate them.
I'm so, the same. Yeah.
Okay. So yeah. It's a very embodied, and I think this is what my meditation taught me, was the idea of embodiment. And I've also studied embodiment from the perspective of words having space, have an embodied nature to them, but that's another story. So I guess I'd be curious to get into, like, how do we create some of the space, both in a meeting, when we're trying to make decisions, for example, but also literally the space where people can go, now, interestingly enough, being at home, I think that there's more space for people to have to be able to walk away from work, because you have your Zoom and then you can walk away. There's actually more space created. So, but there's eventually, when people come back to the office, there needs to be some sort of safe spaces, if you will, you know, rooms to go, things mm-hmm. like that. So talk yeah. a little bit about that, and then we'll stop.
Well, we turn to an ancient Japanese principle called MA, transliterated. The kanji character is gate and sun, and it's really emphasizing the sun, the light of the sun pouring through a temple gate. And it's a word that is translated to mean silence, to mean nothingness and emptiness, but also to mean pure potentiality, which is one of our favorite ways to look at it. You find it in aesthetics, the Japanese aesthetics of ikebana flower arrangement, if you can imagine that, sort of the branches and the petals of the leaf, but also the emphasis of design is on the space around that. Mm-hmm. On a scroll, it's the swishes of the paintbrush, but there's always a lot of empty space. And in architecture too, the entrances, you know, sort of lots about, it's about what's not there, it's about what's there equally. So that pure potentiality is really valued. And we suggest that pure potentiality is not something we tend to give a lot of room for. It's all about content, content, content. It's meeting, 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 document, 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 what we say, not the listening or hearing or receptivity. And so we suggest that we bring more ma into the job. So maybe that looks like, say, we're in an idea generation kind of session. And rather than it being that just the loudest and the, you know, dominating, as it so often is, which, by the way, really just encourages conventional thinking and, you know, the things that we already say all the time or know all the time, and repetition, to really bring some ma in. So maybe we use some post-it notes and create a wall, a gallery wall we can peruse, or we can even vote silently for the things that we, you know, and anonymously for the things we appreciate. Or maybe we could just have a night to sleep on it, especially if it's an important decision, and let the dream world work its magic.
We talked about that last week. Yeah.
Great.
We actually used that. Someone actually said, what about the space to sleep on it? I said, yeah. Like, awesome. It was like, he actually used those words. Yeah.
All those spaces. So maybe it's a breath. When Justin was talking about contentious meetings, sometimes even just pausing to just connect back into, why is it important that we come to some kind of agreement? Like, for the sake of what are we working on this, to get out of our positionality? So silence really creates space for, I use those synonyms as well, creates an opportunity for us to reflect, get grounded on why it's important, to come up with different ideas, which we love to use with our clients, to get out of conventional thinking, to get out of the dominance of extroversion and verbalness as well, and to bring in more marginalized, more creative, and hopefully more breakthrough ideas as well.
Go ahead.
Sure. Yeah, the essence of what Lee's describing, particularly in a contentious discussion, mm-hmm. you know, comes back to the Quaker way of working.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a principle within the Quaker approach to dialogue called threshing, separating the wheat from the chaff. And silence is an essential means to get there. Mm-hmm. There's a kind of Quaker meeting that's not a meeting for religious purposes, but it's still called a meeting for worship for the purpose of business, where they'll work on business logistical decisions for their communities and organizations. And in these meetings, the clerk, the person presiding, will often call for silence and space, as Lee's describing, not just as a way to turn down the heat, but as a way to elevate and help emerge what's really important in the discussion. And we speak, for example, with a birthright Quaker who's been a senior vice president at PBS and an academic at Harvard, who describes the dynamics of what goes on in that setting. We talk also with Cyrus Habib, who was the son of Iranian immigrants to the US, went blind when he was 8, learned Braille, went on to become a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford, went to Yale Law School, and then became the lieutenant governor of Washington State when he was in his mid-30s. And then when everyone thought he was going to run for governor, he announced he was taking a vow of poverty, chastity, and obedience as a novice Jesuit priest. And we talk with Cyrus before and after this huge jump he made.
And
he into what it was like inside his mind, inside his consciousness, during his first month, which he spent in silence studying the preliminary teachings of the Jesuits right after leaving the lieutenant governor's office. And he describes to us about how, like, he made this decision not in order to leave politics, not in order to leave social action, but in order to do the same work from a place of deep discernment. So rather than thinking about how what he said would appear in a press release or, you know, how he would play on Twitter, for example, he made this decision so that his words and his actions can arise from the silence. So he could be in a place of discernment and coming to this from a place of truth. And this is why, for example, Gandhi, as we explore in the book, spent every Monday not talking. He had a day of silence. Even if he was around other people, he didn't speak, because this was the key to discernment. So, you know, looking to Cyrus, looking to Gandhi, we explore some practices within businesses too. You know, what it means, for example, to have a brainstorming session in silence, you know, to pose a question, and then we all sit together in that magnified power of silence. And maybe after a little while, there's an opportunity to write down some ideas and make a post-it note gallery. And what happens then is you don't have the kind of tyranny of the fastest and loudest.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Interesting.
Great. Yeah.
Well, in last words, I just very interested in what you're talking about and how you've reframed this. I really think you guys are onto something here. I do want to encourage you to go watch this movie.
I saw the rest of the documentary about it.
It's just was so touching. It really is unbelievable that they got those kids out of there. I'm not a big, like, dramatic miracle person, but at the fact all of them lived, there was a death of one of the divers, but but it's truly amazing. But anyway, I think that the application here, I really like that we could apply it to the workplace, apply it at home. I love that you went and interviewed people, and you've got some really good stories about that. And you interviewed such a wide variety of people.
Yeah.
So
it's our joy to carry those stories. And we didn't want it, you know, we don't see ourselves as experts in silence. This is something one could, and we never met an expert in silence. No one would ever describe themselves as such. So it's sort of an infinitely fascinating place of inquiry, but really of the utmost importance. And we see this as us remembering, like coming back to something that we know together for the sake of, you know, maybe something life and death, like what you described. Or for Jarvis, he says, you know, if I let that noise creep in, this is our friend in death row, if I let that noise creep in, I can end up in a dungeon somewhere. If he snaps, you know, it's like, you know, back to solitary or worse. And so, you know, it's of the utmost importance in those situations, but we would argue it's pretty important right now. Our lives saturated with noise, our work saturated with noise, our consciousness saturated with noise, the inability to focus on what we want to focus and intend. This is having a true, real cost. And we need to prioritize and appreciate silence for all it brings us.
Well, thank you so much. You both have websites, justinzorn.com and leemartz.com. It's Lee, L-E-I-G-H, Mars, M-A-R-Z.
Yeah.
And you also are, of course, on LinkedIn, and we can find your book on Amazon, Golden, The Power of Silence in a World of Noise.
Yeah, and we work together as well. Our website for our work together is AstreaStrategies.com, A-S-T-R-E-A, strategies.com.
Astreya Strategies. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. Find Again, us. Thanks to both of you. Mahalo.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.